Hi, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Toy Harp, a podcast about bluegrass. This is the last episode of season two. Here from Nashville is my conversation with Allison Krauss.
I remember, you know, the first time I looked out in the audience and saw people singing words to our songs that only we had recorded. That was just a really crazy moment. Just never thought it'd end up being there. Never thought we'd hear back from Rounder. Yeah. Never thought we would hear from Rounder in the first place.
If this is your first time listening, you can hear full interviews with Jerry Douglas, Allison Brown, Bela Fleck, Larry Sparks, Jody Stecker, and so many more wherever you get your podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Later on.
Oh, hi, and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians. On the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network, it's me, Cindy House, and I host Basic Folk. Thanks for finding us. Very happy to have Humbird on the pod today. I got to see Humbird a couple of times in recent months, once opening up for Margot Silker in Pittsburgh, which was awesome, and then when I attended the Folk Alliance Conference in Kansas City, Humbird was like the act to see, and they were great. More on that in just a bit. First of all, I gotta ask you, are you on Basic Folk's mailing list? Because you really ought to be. It's the place to find out what is happening on the podcast, who's coming up, who's been on recently, and all of our thoughts and feelings about everything that's going on around us. It's easy to sign up. You can do it at the link in the show notes, or you can go to basicfolk.com, and thanks. You can also follow us on social media. We are on Facebook, TikTok, and Instagram. In case you're wondering, Instagram is the platform I post pictures of my dog, and we're at Basic Folk Pod on all three of those platforms. You can also make a contribution to the podcast by going to our website, basicfolk.com. There's a place to make a contribution, donation, or you can go to our store and get a Basic Folk beanie that is handmade by this podcast's mother. You can find a link in the show notes for that or go to basicfolk.com. Okay. Suri Undlin, better known as Humbird, is a talented singer-songwriter from the Twin Cities with deep roots in Minnesota music and the land that surrounds her. Growing up, she was a true cold-weather kid who loved hockey during winter in Minnesota, but also loved music and feeding her vivid imagination. Her love of music was nurtured by her parents, religious music, church choir, and also her Aunt Joan, who taught Suri guitar at age 12. Hockey actually led her to her first band, Celtic Club, with a set of triplets. The band would play at Irish pubs, talent shows, and of course, at the local hockey rink. The band introduced her to Celtic music and her first live performances. Undlin shares her rich experience studying folklore and fairy tales, which greatly influenced her musical journey. She discusses her intensive research in Ireland and Nordic countries, exploring how music intertwines with storytelling traditions. Throughout the episode, Undlin reflects on her upbringing, her time at an art school, and her evolving approach to songwriting, blending traditional folk music with indie music and experimental sounds. On her new album, Right On, Suri is acknowledging and addressing white supremacy in Middle America, as highlighted in her song Child of Violence. She talks candidly about what writing and releasing the song taught her about white supremacy. Touring has provided Suri with unexpected challenges and valuable insights, shaping her perspective as a musician and performer. We talk about the importance of being open to chaos and disciplined in one's mindset while navigating the music industry and life on the road. Let's take a listen to that song I was just talking about, Child of Violence. This is from Humbird's new album, Ride On. And then we'll get to our conversation with Suri Undlin of Humbird on Basic Folk.
Water.
You ready to get into it?
Yeah.
Okay, it's going to be so fun. Some of my questions have long setups, so please bear with me. First of all, let's talk about your love of Minnesota. So you have a deep devotion, loyalty, and a sense of responsibility to the landscape of the Upper Minnesota Valley. You're a descendant of many European immigrants to that area, and you often sit with that identity and are learning and unlearning what that means in North America. Shout out to Sadie Gustafson-Zook. You were on her podcast recently.
Mm-hmm.
You have a Norwegian name, Siri, which is it short for something else?
No.
Okay.
Just Siri.
And then maybe your other siblings have Norwegian names. I learned one was Liv. But what do
Liv, Jens, and Mikkel.
Oh my gosh. Great.
My other siblings.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What do you know of your family ancestry, and how do you feel connected with them through the place that you're from?
Wow, what a juicy question. Well, to anyone who isn't like familiar with Minnesota in particular, there was like a massive immigration of Scandinavians here, and those communities stayed pretty tight-knit when they arrived. So even though I'm like fifth or sixth generation removed from Norway and Sweden, still a lot of names from that part of the world, and a lot of like food, especially around the holidays, and a lot of pride coming from Scandinavia within those communities.
What kind of food are we talking about?
Cookies, lefse in particular. If anyone's familiar with lefse, it's just like the most disgusting way to consume fish you possibly could, but it's like mandatory if that's part of your lineage. But all that being said, you know, that's something you kind of grow up learning about just around the kitchen table and also at church and stuff. But as an adult, sort of learning the true history of this continent and reckoning with, you know, the other parts of the story that maybe my family didn't even know to talk about or wasn't aware of at all. And just sort of trying to find the place to be and the ways to move with a lot of stories that intersect. So, I feel very loyal to this landscape because I was born here, and it has been such a gift to be at home here, but also acknowledging that I'm very much a guest, even though my family has been here for a long time.
I recently watched the show 1883, which is like the pre-story to Yellowstone. I don't know if you've seen that or not. It's on Paramount Plus. It is gruesome, but it's like, I was thinking about your ancestors. It's like brutal what people who did the Oregon Trail, for our Oregon listeners. what people went through. Can't recommend watching it because it's so brutal.
Because it's so intense.
But Faith Hill and Tim McGraw are in it, and they are dreamboats. So maybe if you want to, you know, check out some hot celebs.
It's gruesome, but hot people are going through it.
Yeah, hot people are drowning and getting cut in half things. But anyways, okay, back to the show. I'm trying to figure out how you feel about winter. You obviously grew up in a very, very cold environment, and a couple of things that I've picked up along the way. So your bio says you're inspired by the crystalline chill of her home state's northern winters. I also read that it's hard for you to be productive if it's not freezing, but Siri, in the song Blueberry Bog on the new record, you sing, "Nights are getting short and there's buds on the trees. I'm so ready for spring, I could get down on my knees." So
yeah,
tell me about your maybe complicated feelings about winter.
Definitely complicated. That's how it is. I feel like it depends so much on where you're at internally, how you navigate winter. But yeah, I think living here and growing up here, I have a deep appreciation for it, even when it's not easy. But yeah, by the time the buds are showing up on the tree branches, it's a very specific type of euphoria to know that things are going to warm up.
It's happening now.
Yeah, it really, it's like right now, and I know it's muddy, at least here it's muddy outside. It can be actually kind of hard to figure out how to spend quality time out there because it's wet and sticky and can be kind of intense, but yeah, just staring at the trees helps a lot. Yeah.
Growing up, your mom was a Lutheran preacher. Is she still at that?
Yeah. She actually recently retired, but
Oh, congrats.
yeah, congrats to her. She worked a long time for a lot of people and for this cause bigger than her. And I admire that a lot, but I'm excited to see what she does next.
There's lots
Yeah.
of like music surrounding church. You would sing in church choir, and your mom would have you sing before every meal. I don't know what you would sing, but I imagine it was like something religious about being thankful for the meal. And you have
Yeah.
early memories where you like didn't know the words to what you were singing, but you were like happy to be singing with everyone. So when did you start to like understand religion, and how did that change your relationship to the songs and the kind of like spiritual music that you were surrounded by at church?
Well, I guess I'll start by saying I still don't understand religion fully, and I think it will continue to be a baffling, disturbing and mysterious concept for my whole life. If anyone has any clarifying insight on the intricacies of why us humans are so preoccupied with our religions, I'm all ears. I think it's a fascinating topic and also a harrowing one. But I think that in the Lutheran tradition, it can be sort of a reserved and quiet culture, but when it comes to the music, there's a lot of praise and just like gratefulness and thankfulness towards the natural world and like abundance when it's on your table. And even today, that's still generally things I can get behind. Like when we're singing as a family before meals, because we still do that.
Cute.
Even as someone who, yeah, even as someone who's had a long and winding path away from organized religion, there are really nice moments of being at the table together and just pausing, before sharing a meal is a powerful thing, no matter what. Yeah.
So, how has faith and religious imagery played into your writing? Because it does pop up in your songs from time to time. And then how did your writing help you? I mean, you say you don't understand it, but like clarify some things about spirituality and religion.
Yeah, I think that especially with a mom who's a religious leader, and also my grandfather is a Lutheran preacher, an uncle as well, a great uncle. So there's very much the tradition of like getting up in front of people and telling a story, and then also the concept of like a calling from a greater source. You can put that within a Christian framework, but if you broaden it out and just look at the concepts in general, it's really not that different from music, at its best. I think when it's rooted in the concepts of love and belonging and community and activism, those are the same words that I think of when I think of music that moves me. So ultimately, I didn't grow up in a house with professional musicians, but as I've done more and more music and it's become my livelihood, it's kind of fascinating to look at the overlaps and be like, actually, this is not that different from what my mom does and what I grew up watching her do, which was like pointing to beauty, pointing to old stories as a way to instruct us on how to move in our present moment and how to do so in a way that's like rooted in love. But I also have the privilege of growing up in a house that was within a Christian framework that was rooted in love, and I know that's like not that's not the case for many people. So it's sort of a unique situation, but it definitely propels me in moments where I'm not sure what I'm doing or what the point is. There is this voice, I think, from just the way I was brought up, which is like there are things you don't understand. Trust the process, trust that there's like a creative source that we're all kind of tapping into, and sometimes you don't need to understand it to be partaking in it. And yeah, that's one beautiful thing that I think I grew up with.
That's nice. And also appreciate the note about your experience not being everyone's experience, but it's nice to hear. It's nice to hear about it. You have four siblings, or you have three siblings. So you're one of four.
Mm-hmm.
You're all close
of four.
Age. Yeah. Are you, what order are you in the kids?
I'm the oldest.
You're the oldest. Okay. That was going to be my guess, but I didn't want to be wrong.
Yeah. Do I exude older sister energy?
Yeah. Well, I feel like I heard you talking about leave, and you were talking about the age difference, and I did quick girl math, and then I came to that conclusion. Okay, so all four kids close in age, you would all play together, which sounds like so cute. A lot of your early memories have your siblings in them, so you just were around each other all the time, and were playing together, probably. Maybe some fighting too, but how do you think the way you engaged in play with your siblings continue to like impact your imagination?
Oh, what a great question. Well, I think with the siblings that I have, and I'm sure other people experience this with friends too, but when you have this like little unit, there's just such a shared language. Maybe language isn't the right word, but you know, you can be wrestling around on the concrete on the driveway, or you can be like romping through the woods. And it's sort of this, you know, the characters shift, the games shift, but there's this sort of shared universe that you all inhabit. And I think that does inform my creative process a lot in that, like, you can experiment, you can change, you don't have to stay stuck, but it is all part of this kind of cosmos that you create. You contribute to, and you also have lots of collaborators in, and it's cool that you phrased the question that way. I never really thought about how also the Humbird project, there is definitely a sibling energy with my bandmates and the producers that we've worked with. It's just, yeah, it's a great sort of like same characters, different play kind of feel. Mm-hmm. And everyone is, like, most of the collaborators are based in the Midwest too. So everyone kind of is working with the same landscape at heart. And yeah, it's cool to notice that through line. Thanks for asking that question. I've thought about it.
There is like I had the word in my head and I don't want to say like, I want to say like a childlike quality to Humbird.
Mm-hmm.
And the imagination of your songs and of you just really come out full force. And then hearing the fact that like you had this, you know, little gang of kids that would play in the woods all the time. I wanted to hear more about it. Okay.
Yeah.
Here we go. You had a lot of adult encouragement when you were a kid. So teachers and grownups would like encourage you and urge you to keep writing, keep pursuing music. And you decided when you were young, like very young, that you wanted to be a singer-songwriter, which is kind of amazing. What was your confidence like over the course of your formative years when it came to your dream? And then like, what is it like now because of that?
Oh, doozy of a question. You're really good at asking questions. Well, yeah, I definitely wasn't thinking about it as a job when I was little. I was just like, this is my favorite thing to do. I want to do this. And when people would ask, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I would say a singer. No one like pushed back on it necessarily, you know, because when you're like 6 years old, people aren't like, think more realistically. Right. They're like, you can be anything you want to be.
Get a plan
it's like
B.
When you're older than people. Yeah. Yeah, the kind of plan B encouragement happened later. But I think because I was so consistently excited about singing and making up silly songs and experimenting on the instruments I could find, that, yeah, I did get a lot of encouragement. And I also, not to like just bring it back to Minnesota with every question we're talking about, but Minnesota does have like really great, generally has pretty great funding for the arts in public schools. So even though that's not the case for a lot of people, like when I was growing up and excited about music and in school, it was like, well, there's the band room, or like, there's the choir room, like go for it. Mm-hmm. And there's even a public art school in the Twin Cities, and I attended that as a high schooler, which was like really focused music time. So in some ways it was like very much a reflection of a community that invests in the art and mm-hmm. also has the capacity to invest in the arts. And I can't remember the second part of your question.
What's your confidence like now?
Oh yeah, totally different. I feel like when you're young and you're like, oh yeah, it definitely is gonna work to be a musician. And then you like go out and do it and you tour while you have a bunch of side jobs and you just like string it together. And confidence has hit rock bottom plenty of times, but generally I try to honor it as like a cycle, and there's going to be the low points and the high points and everything in between. That framework has worked well for me so far, but yeah.
Another reference to Sadie's great podcast, Dear Balladeer. You were talking about how you are not only like a singer-songwriter, you're a writer-writer. You write every day, poems, essays, short stories that you keep private. So I'm wondering, like, out of all the mediums for your writing, why was music the one that you really wanted?
Well, I think I want or appreciate all of them for different reasons, but in particular, music is such a community endeavor, at least the way I experience it, like gathering in a space and someone singing or collaborating with fellow musicians or performances is just such a, in my opinion, it's such a gathering-centric art form, and it's really ephemeral in that way. It like floats in the room invisibly and we all experience it vibrationally. It's just like this magical thing that we get to experience all the time. Whereas writing, in my experience, is very private and solitary. And I love that about it too. And often, if I'm out in the world performing too much and not spending enough time alone writing, I will get really off kilter, and I can feel that internally. So I think they're actually all part of the same spectrum of expression for me. It's just like some of it just feels so naturally performative and external, whereas on the other end it's like really reflective and internal, and I'm just way more careful about sharing that type of thing.
Maybe one day we'll get the tell-all with all these essays and short stories.
I hope so. Or just like I was talking recently about how like the ultimate goal is to just be like a wild old lady writing romance novels. Like that's my ultimate goal, and that's what I'm trying to get to. But you can't write great romance novels if you don't have like a full life of experience to draw from. So I'm really just making the most of it until I get to write like erotica in a treehouse. Yeah.
Well, we need to get like a cottage by the shore. You need to be a widow and lots of Afghans and like a medium long-haired old pussycat.
Yeah, and like a pet squirrel or something. Oh. Like I'm open to all the whimsical possibilities, but I have to earn it first. Okay. I have to do the miles first.
This is a question about wanting to help. And it came out of, I heard you talk about the first song that you wrote, which came from a pretty intense place. Your little sister, Leave, when she was between the ages of 1 and 2, had some serious health problems and was in the hospital a lot. Mm-hmm. And you were like somewhere between 5 and 7, maybe. And you would make up little songs and sing them to her. They were like 60-second songs. And adults were like, "Yeah, those are great. Did you write that? Keep doing that. Keep singing to her and making up songs for Leave. Make things up and sing to her. It'll help her." So how much of like making music is about helping people? And how do you think that like very early experience impacts your intention to help?
Well, I mean, if I'm being honest, I think music is 100% about helping. And that can be helping others. That can be helping myself. But ultimately, it's just like there's a song that can help you with wherever you're at. Yeah. I like firmly believe that. I think of it as like a sacred endeavor. And it doesn't look the same for everyone, but I think the equation is there. Like whatever is going on for you, a song can help. And a song isn't going to fix things necessarily, but it can really empower us to find that third way, that impossible way. Mm-hmm. It can help us endure the impossible. And so I just think 100%.
I like the things you say.
Yeah, it doesn't mean that it can't be other things too, but yeah, I think that's like all of it. The root of all of it is that.
All right, now I want to talk about Aunt Joan. And I appreciate the fact that you say aunt and not aunt.
I probably say both depending on where I'm at and who I'm around.
No.
Okay, Aunt Joan.
You were taught guitar by your aunt when you were 12, and she sounds like an important person in your life because of that. And also it sounds like she probably helped you in a couple different ways, but I also heard she helped you record your first songs or like get you the access to record. So tell me more about Joan and what it was like to have an older female musician and relative to look up to while you were first learning.
Oh, yeah. My Aunt Joan is an amazing person. And she's really generous with knowledge. And one of her areas of expertise happens to be music. She played church music. That was like part of her profession. And I think, it just comes back to like auntie power, where like these like older women in your life who pause and notice and spend time with you, whether that's teaching you a couple guitar chords or going for a walk, like leaving a house that can be really chaotic and having quiet time, or just checking in on you. My Aunt Joan still texts me all the time and is like, hey, how you doing over there? And I actually just became an aunt for the first time, and I'm like so stoked to be an aunt.
Congrats.
What a cool role. Yeah, it just seems like we have a Mother's Day and we have a Father's Day, but we should have Auntie Day. Mm-hmm. They don't get enough love where like they just kind of can keep the world moving, you know, when parents are overwhelmed or under supported. Mm-hmm. The aunties come in and save the day.
Yeah,
all the love to Aunt Joan.
Heck yeah. Tell her hello from us here on the Basic Folk Podcast. Another reference to our BFF, Sadie. On Dear Balladeer, you talked about your different identities and you said, my womanhood and experience of being a woman is important to you. So we just spoke of Joan. Where were your role models for being a woman when you were younger? Like, not just people that, you know, were physically in your life, but like any kind of like cultural exterior influences, like, and how helpful or how detrimental were they as you got older and wiser?
I mean, I think in some ways I got really lucky just based on what I naturally gravitated to, which was Avril Lavigne and her tie and Skater Boy. And I would just come home every day after school and sing that entire record into a tiny karaoke machine at the top of my lungs. And when I felt that I should branch out from Avril Lavigne, I think I got a Michelle Branch CD. And from there, I got an Alanis Morissette CD. So I think I was kind of growing up in the like late 90s, early 2000s, when I was like just such a sponge. And it just so happened that there were all these like incredibly badass confessional female songwriters who were like at the root of it were like, life's hard.
Yeah.
Here's how I feel about it. And it was like the perfect thing to be like 13 years old and just singing at the top of my lungs. And honestly, when I go back to those songs, I'm like, I stand by this. Like my 13-year-old self was right on. I still love this stuff. And of course, like, you know, Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera were also in there. But I think I found those artists more confusing than anything. Like, I was like mystified and enchanted by them, but also confused because it was like, I don't know anyone who dresses like that.
Yeah.
Or who talks like that. Like it just felt like sort of a foreign country listening to that music.
A little bit.
Yeah, that's another word for it.
By the industry.
Yeah. Yeah, the stuff I really was like obsessive about I turn on today and I'm like, yeah, still.
Hell yeah. So you came of age in like a really interesting time. This is something I love to talk about in this podcast, and listeners may be sick of hearing me talk about this, but there was like this piece of legislation passed, the Telecommunications Act of 1996, where media companies were allowed to hold monopolies on markets across the United States. So all these like independent radio stations and other media outlets were kind of like swept up by Clear Channel. So then radio became way more homogenized. So if you like think about like top 40 radio at the beginning of the 90s and into the mid 90s, it was like you know, Pearl Jam, Indigo Girls, Prince, Mariah Carey, Whitney Houston, Salt and Pepper. And then you get to the end of the 90s and it's like NSYNC, Backstreet Boys, Britney Spears, Christina Aguilera. And somehow like artists like Avril Lavigne also got through
somehow.
But it's, it's like interesting to think about this like fucked up legislation, how it's like continuously impacted our society in ways that are, it's just like immeasurable ways that it's impacted. So like, I wonder, like, I think I'm maybe like 10 years older than you. So I wonder like if we were the same age, like, would I be gravitating towards like the Avril Lavigne and the Michelle Branches? Because when I was in high school and middle school, it was like for the women that I would gravitate towards, it was more like Alanis Morissette, Tori Amos, PJ Harvey, Bjork. Kind of like the weirdos, you know. But it's cool to hear you talk about like the weirdos of your coming of age years as well.
Well, and I think the weirdos I'm talking about were listening to the weirdos you're talking about. You know, like it is definitely part of a lineage of just women unafraid to experiment and like be real about their human experience.
Yeah.
I think, it's interesting to hear you talk about that legislation. It's such a, feels like such a mirror to what happens today with venues and like Live Nation also.
Yeah,
like
Live Nation sort of formerly was, used to be Clear Channel. So they owned
all so the it's radio stations. The same people.
Yep, all the radio stations, all the venues, all the billboards out there. There's still, I think there still is Clear Channel billboards, but it's now Live Nation. And Clear Channel radio is now iHeartRadio.
Oh, sneaky.
Yeah.
And, okay, so they have a pattern. It'd be cool to interrupt it, or, if only.
They need some therapy. Okay, cool. Back to the show. Celtic Club. Of course you knew we were going to talk about.
You really have done your research. I'm so impressed.
Well, listen, Celtic Club, you knew we were going to talk about it. As soon as we brought up Aunt Joan, you were like, oh no, I know what's next. Celtic Club, which is your Irish band with the triplets. And you all met, of course, through playing hockey. You would play in Irish pubs, talent shows, and hockey tournaments. You learned a bunch of traditional Irish songs, and I can definitely hear that influence in your music, especially on the song. The one that I hear it the most in is On the Day We Are Together Again, which, oh my God.
For sure.
I saw you open for Margot Silker in Pittsburgh. My wife and I were there, and you played that song last, and we were like, God damn it. We are dead now. We died.
Sorry about that. Yeah,
it's all right.
A doozy.
But can you talk more about where Irish elements continue to impact your sound and how you are using those types of melodies to evoke emotions?
Yeah, well, the Celtic Club was like one of the more like formative experiences as a young person. And pretty cool to be listening to like Avril Lavigne. And then after hockey practice, going over to the Coughlin's house.
Yeah, let's
and
put on the chief.
Studying traditional Irish music. Yeah, and it was, I think in some ways my, I didn't realize this at the time as a kid, but because I'm not from a family that's Irish, it was a very lighthearted thing. Ultimately, it was like, I love singing with my friends and this is like their history and their traditions. And I just get to be part of it. Like it was such a, it feels like such a serendipitous cool thing, and it always felt that way.
You guys weren't talking about the Troubles?
We were not. Yeah, that was kind of, that wasn't, I don't know that we knew much about it. But it, I mean, I did learn because the Celtic Club was such a positive experience. I then went and studied music in Ireland and like was exposed to all of like the political radicalism and undertones of some of the songs in the balladry tradition, and just like the concept of, you know, a neighborhood and how songs can be that specific. That was sort of, I didn't catch that this side of the Atlantic. Mm. And so, yeah, studying music over there and realizing how specific it could be, and how the more specific it was, like I was still relating to it as someone from a totally different place, and just feeling so moved by the way the melodies could evoke emotion while telling a story. I mean, it's just, yeah, it's a pretty, it's hard to put words around a tradition that's so profound, but you can't be around it and not be changed by it.
So was it something with the, so like, I'm interested in hearing more about like, this melody makes me feel a certain way. I want to incorporate that into my music. So I don't know how much like music theory, you know, like if you're like, okay, I know that these chords are part of this such and such progression, and I'm going to put those chords in my music. Or if you're like, this makes me feel a certain way, I'm going to do like an imitation almost of it. Mm-hmm. I don't know. The imitation sounds like a negative reinterpretation of it in your music.
Yeah, no, I don't hear it that way. I think that's accurate. I think I'm not a music theory person. I can read music in an emergency and it's not going to go well is kind of how I talk about it. It's like, can someone play the piano? It'd be like me, but really badly. That's yeah. like how that feels.
That's me in Spanish.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, if no one else can, I'll try. But yeah, it's all feeling, it's all emotion and intuition. And I think that's part of why the Irish tradition spoke so much to me, especially when I was, it still does, but when I was younger, I was so drawn to it because it's also really oral. Like you're not at the pub with your sheet music, you know, you're just listening and repeating it over and over to yourself and finding ways to imitate it. But then also within that tradition, you always talk about who you learned the songs from and where you learned the song. So it doesn't feel like theft or stealing. It actually just is like, well, this is where I was, this is who I learned it from, and there are some variations because of this, this, and this. And it just feels like a ongoing dialogue that can be had in a respectful way and not appropriative. So yeah, that it's an exciting thing to sit with and learn from.
So you doing all that intensive studying, was that part of your Watson Fellowship?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'd love to hear more about it. It sounds like you went to Ireland and conducted extensive folklore and musical research around the world is what they say about you. So could you talk more about that experience, and then how did that change your musicality?
Yeah. Well, I, as an undergrad, I was studying folklore and fairy tales, and also just how music overlapped with that topic.
Fairy
and
tales.
The Watson. Yeah.
That's amazing.
So fun. Yeah. I could go off about fairy tales.
Can you just tell me how do you spell fairy?
I spell it with an I. F-A-I.
Wow. Traditional.
R-Y.
Very traditional.
Fine. But yeah, so I took off as like a 22-year-old with this research grant for 1 year to look at how people use music to tell stories and how people use music to remember stories. Because so often there's these choruses that are repeated and you can really internalize them. And I was focusing specifically on the Celtic countries and the Nordic countries and the ways that the stories and melodies moved between the two, because there was so much trade and interaction, which is like a very benign way of putting it. But looking back now, I'm like, oh, it's funny. It was like this love I found through friends, the Irish tradition, and trying to sort of like find the connections with my own family history on like a microcosm level. But ultimately, when you're in Norway or Sweden or even up in Sápmi with like the Sami people, and then you're down in Scotland and Ireland, it's amazing the overlapping themes and melody lines that you hear. And
wow.
There were times where I would hear a traditional story in I don't know, Edinburgh. And then, you know, like 2 months later in Oslo, someone would be like, let me tell you an old Norwegian story, and be like the same story. Yeah. And just an appreciation of how in these folk traditions, like these songs and stories like deeply belong to some people, but also they're bigger than that. And they have sort of their own agenda. Sometimes they're like sentient beings that float around and land places.
I'm ready to sign up for the Humbird European vacation tour.
Fairy tale.
Yeah.
The someday
event of a
cool.
lifetime. I just got off the Kiamo cruise.
How was that?
It was really fun. Like I was just like, okay, cool. Yeah, this obviously like a lot of my favorite musicians are going to be on this.
Yeah.
But I've never been on a cruise and it's so weird, but it was actually really fun. I think you would, I talked to somebody today who's played a Kiamo and they were like, I did not like it. It's like the cruise aspect of it is like pretty heavy, mm-hmm. you know, like the food is terrible. The cruise is weird, but like I found the and it's like all so wasteful being on a cruise, but I found the community that it created, like the week long community it created, to kind of outweigh the weirdness of the cruise. But anyways, I await the sign up page on humburgmusic.com for the
fairy tale cruise,
freaky folky fairy tale cruise with Humbird.
Yeah, we're taking a flying sailboat. It will be via clouds along the Milky Way. We'll get to wherever we go eventually.
Great. Can you also see if Tori Amos is available for this? Because I think she would be down.
That'd be pretty cool.
Okay, let's go back to high school real quick. Because you were so serious about music, you attended an art school, which is actually a public school in the Twin Cities, Perpich.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like
Perpich Center for the Arts.
It sounds like it was a pretty positive experience for you, but it's like, sounds like a lot of pressure that you were like putting on yourself. Like, what was it like to have such an intense passion for music and such a directed path when you were so young?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that is just sort of my experience. So I don't know that I felt it was like any more pressure than other people. And luckily, I think with a large family and playing hockey, I also played soccer. Like my days were pretty like diverse, I guess. Like I wasn't like only playing music and feeling like the pressure of music. It was more so like whenever I had downtime or quiet time, it was like, oh, I'd like to be playing guitar in my room by myself. And I think going to the art school was sort of, that was when I sort of had to quit other things and just really focus on it.
No more hockey.
No more hockey. That was a hard one. But it was great because at this art school, you got to do music for a lot of the day. And in some ways that was a relief. Like back at my, the public school I was at, I was like signed up for music stuff, but I would have to go every other day to different ones. So like one day would be band, one day would be choir. I never got to be there every day because they were the same hour. And I was always really bummed out by that. So when I got to Perpich, I could just finally like fully dive in and not feel like I was trying to make the most out of like really like small spaces of time. And it was also a good lesson in the end. When I graduated and went to college, I actually started playing hockey again. And I think that there, even though that was 2 years at art school that were really intense.
Watch those old bones.
It all like came. I know. But I think things like they come around again if you really love them. And just because as a young person, I had 2 really intense years didn't mean that other interests didn't like circle back around. So
it
was a good lesson to learn younger.
Yeah, I really love that. About your writing. So there are a lot of times on the new record where you are writing outwardly facing songs. When did that start becoming a thing for you? And how hard is it to go inward or outward, like in either direction in your writing, if you know what I mean by inward, outward.
I do. Okay. I do. And I think in some ways, like as a songwriter, you can be kind of tricky about it. Like there are certain songs on this new record that are like, they use the word you, and it sounds like I'm talking to somebody, but like ultimately I'm also talking to myself. So the internal is external. And I think this record's focus is outward, whereas like the previous Humbird record, Still Life, was very inward. And I think that's just an overall tone of the whole record. But ultimately, like anything I'm saying to somebody else, I probably also need to hear. So
yeah,
they're not so separate.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a very similar question, but similar but different. You have talked about when you were young, you used music as a therapeutic tool. And you would only write when you were upset. And now you treat it as a discipline and a craft and obviously more serious about it. But when did that start to change for you? And how did you see your songs changing?
Well, it continues to change all the time. Like, I think I have said that in the past, like it's more of a discipline and a craft now. But also in this season of my life, I haven't written a song in 3 or 4 months, like no discipline at all. And that's just like the season that I'm in.
Is that worrisome or is that okay?
I am okay with it. I just trust that when I am ready to tackle certain things, I will. And songwriting is an amazing tool to sort out your thoughts and your own heart. And I just haven't been in a season of wanting to do that right now, but I have those. And sometimes the well is dry, and I don't think freaking out is going to help at all, but it can be an indication that things are off balance. It's like, well, why don't I want to write? Well, I was on tour over 100 days last year. Like, I'm probably tired. And the creative voice is like, yo, could we just like sleep for a little while before we write more music? And that's so like on some days I'm like sad because writing songs is so fun, but it'll come back. And, yeah, the songs are totally different when they're a craft. I think they're actually harder when you're looking at it as a discipline and you're using your muscles and your tools. Whereas like sometimes when you're upset, it's like just getting like struck by lightning, and the songs take like 1 minute to write. And then like years later, you're like, I didn't even edit it. Yeah. But I still love this song. I love to sing this song, but it's like, it's more like a lightning bolt than it is like building a house. I think they're both important, but as a songwriter, like I'll always know which is which. Like, and I think sometimes like pals of mine whose songwriting I know really well, you can even listen close and be like, oh, that one happened fast. And like, you just were like trying to keep up with your pen. You can kind of hear it in people's style sometimes.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. I've never heard anyone put it like that. It's so smart. Mm-hmm. Like listening to Bob Dylan talk about his early songs, he's like, I don't remember writing any of these songs. So he just must've been like in such a mental state, but now, you know, it's at a certain point it turned and everything.
Do you
know Peter Mulvey?
Yeah.
So he calls those like lightning songs God songs. Like these are songs God gave. And he's like, Anais Mitchell has so many
Someone
of these
else
songs.
Wrote this.
Yeah, he's like, I have one, you know, he's got a song and stuff. I like to think about that, like the God songs, like Bob Dylan's his first three albums like that.
Yeah. Here, Bob, here's a whole record for you.
From the Lord.
God,
you're an artist who, as we spoke of earlier, you have seriously studied the folk tradition, but you're also a freaky weirdo who enjoys experimenting with your sound. Where do you think that side of you came from? And what do you like about playing with tradition?
Man, you are so good at questions. I want to get a beer with you sometime late at night and talk all night.
Done deal.
But this also podcast is also awesome. But I think the experimental side is really a credit to Minneapolis and the Twin Cities music scene, which has a lot of genres going on and like a cool history, like whether you're looking at Prince or you're looking at the Replacements or even bands like Semisonic, and just established venues like First Ave, just so much music coming through that was weird, just so weird. And I think it trickles down, and also in a place that's kind of, Minneapolis isn't necessarily isolated, but it can really feel that way sometimes. And people just always shifting who they're working with and experimenting. There's such a collaborative feel as far as like who's in a band and what are they making now. That's always been my experience in that city. And I think having fallen in love with traditional music so early on, but also recognizing that it's not really my tradition, I never want to like pretend to be something that I'm not. So paying homage to the traditions that I'm moved by while also incorporating like our modern experience and a scene that I'm a part of, which is in Minneapolis. And I always had bandmates that were like, you should get weirder. You should try this. And instead of shutting it down, being like, okay, yeah, let's try it. And we've walked this winding road for a few years now. Yeah.
And you're doing a really cool job, particularly the new album, which is so fucking good. Good work.
Thanks. Thank you so much.
Okay. So the new album, Right On. Okay. This is a line from one of the press releases. It says, endurance in the face of uncertainty, having the guts to try, even if you might be wrong. So Siri, this album is like poised to be the most widely received of all your albums, which is all one can hope for in the trajectory of a career, to just keep growing and growing and growing. One might say it might be a breakout album for Humbird. One might say.
We'll see.
Well, okay, with that in mind, how are you feeling about uncertainty these days?
Yeah, it's scary and inevitable. I think that I've learned a lot in the last year just from touring and navigating elements of the music industry that I never knew about and never knew how to navigate. Like, it's just, in some ways it has been a doozy of a 12 months, and I have been super focused on like eating healthy and spending time with the ones I love at home this past winter and kind of recovering a sense of self after just a lot of places and a lot of faces and a lot of miles. But in some ways it feels fitting with the Right On record to be where it's at, because actually me and my bandmates have been playing this record for like 2 years already live, just because we were an indie band from Minneapolis.
That's why you're so tight.
Yeah. It's sort of like, we've always operated under the idea that like there are no rules. And when you are an indie band from Minneapolis, just seeing what might happen next, it's like, well, let's play the music we're excited about. So I feel like this record actually was tight before we even went into the studio. These songs were like being performed every night, and that hadn't happened before with the record. So it feels like a very actualized offering. Like, these songs have seen miles. They've been on the tow truck. They've been on the cat dander couch. Like, they've traveled far already. So in some ways it's like overdue that the record is coming out, and I'm excited for these songs to like be, I feel like when they're finally on an album, it feels like a celebration. Like, here's a pile, and it's a really good pile. Here you go. And these songs have like, they've done the work already just out in the world, that it feels like just a fun thing to finally present them.
It's hard to pick a favorite track on Right On, but I'm going to go with the one song you've gotten hate mail about. That would be Child of Violence. It explores the legacy and impact of white supremacy in Middle America. And you say, reflections on the ways in which white supremacy is part of me, part of so much of what surrounds us, and the ways in which we can break that pattern and work to repay the impossible debt that inheritance creates. Whoo! Plus it fucking rules. What has writing and releasing this song and being able to reflect on its contents taught you about white supremacy?
Yeah. I mean, still so much to learn. I think in particular, performing this song over the last couple of years in different places has just reaffirmed how just sneaky white supremacy can be and how it looks so different in different places. Because Will, this song has also given me an opportunity to be really direct on stage and be like, this is what this song is about. And just so you're not confused, dear audience, like, this is what we're talking about, and hoping to just dismantle completely once and for all and be one small part of that process altogether. So it feels good to just be direct about that on stage, but it is pretty wild how different it lands and feels in the room when you're like in a small parlor room in Brooklyn or a county festival in Wisconsin, or, you know, like, no matter where you end up, people hear that differently. And ultimately it leads to like really interesting conversations at the merch table. I think because I look a certain way and I inhabit space a certain way, people of a lot of different opinions are comfortable talking to me, which it's like can be more or less pleasant depending on how a person chooses to do that. But ultimately, like, I am the person who should be having that conversation with folks. Like, it's not my black and brown pals making great music that need to be doing that work. Like, I should be the one in the room saying, here's what we're talking about, here's what we need to work on, and like, are you with me or not? And then like, yeah, give me your opinion, send me your hate mail. Like, that's I think that's just part of the responsibility of all white identifying folks in this day and age, is like, it's overdue that we're doing the work like that. So
So Lizzie Noh co-hosts this podcast, and they just released their new album Halfsies, which my friend of mine told me I say the name of the album wrong, but I'm gonna continue to say it wrong. So they have a song called Deadbeat that is like very like, you know, I've done wrong so many times and you just keep coming back to me type of like song that I was like, I'm not super comfortable with the way that you're talking about my friend Lizzie. And and that led to like a really interesting conversation about how like the space for like self-deprecation is usually reserved for men. So it like completely opened my eyes, and it also makes me appreciate Child of Violence more so, because you're like, white supremacy is part of me. And, you know, you're not just like, you guys need to work on this. You're like, you have to work on this and I have to work on this, you know?
Absolutely. And in writing that song, I wasn't like, I'm gonna get on stage and sing about this so people wake up or something. More so I was like, this is so part of me. How do I feel about this? How do I unbraid these strands and like really become aware of them? And how do I, like, the song was fully selfish in its intention of like, here's what I'm learning, here's what I'm observing, how do I hold this, how do I move forward knowing this? And you know, eventually with a song you are going to be performing it for people, and you think about that at a certain point in the writing process, but that wasn't like the impetus for the song. It was very much like calling myself out and sitting with it in myself.
You were so selfish. I want to ask.
It's important to be sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what Basic Folk is all about: being selfish and a dirtbag. You were talking about this a little bit earlier, and I wanted to hear more about tour. You posted on your Instagram recently, like a roundup of photos from tour and like a really cool reflection. And you said, this work continues to teach and challenge me in ways I can't anticipate. So what have been some surprising lessons you've come away with because of touring?
Some surprising lessons. I mean, in the act of touring, like, you just have to be like so open to chaos, because you like wake up in the morning and you're like, well, let's go find out what happens. We have a ideal plan, like you have a schedule and that's the ideal and you hope that it all happens. But I think what I've been most surprised by is just the way that, this is going to sound like some self-help book or something, and I really don't mean it that way, but moving through the world at that pace And with such, like, you really have to, like, you got a backpack and you're in it for 4 months. And I think it, if anything, has like hardened me and softened me. And I have to be really careful about which part of that I'm leaning into. And I think that's been the surprise. Before you are on the road, it just is like, it's so romantic, it's so exciting, like, we're gonna go play music. And that is true also, but I didn't anticipate like the just sheer amount of like heavy lifting of internal work that has to happen in order to like remain functional on the road and able to perform. And I don't say that as like a pity party, it's just like, you have to be really disciplined in your mind. And in the times where I haven't remained disciplined, I've like paid a really high price mentally, like when I get home. So it almost feels like tour is like a martial art or something, or like a mindfulness practice where you just have to sort of like walk this tightrope every day. And that's not how it looks like on the outside. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that that's how it felt at first, but now that I'm years into the act of it, yeah, it's like acrobatics sometimes, it feels like.
Mm.
So that's a surprise.
Cool.
It's not like a fun surprise, I guess, but.
So many gems coming from this interview.
Oh.
Really good. Okay. We're going to, before I let you go, we're going to do something very fun and you're going to love it so much.
Okay.
It's awesome. The lightning round.
Woo. Cool.
Okay. Here we go. What is your must-have winter accessory?
Hat or gloves, both. You can't choose, because if your head gets cold and your hands get cold, you're done.
Okay, good tip.
Yeah.
What is the best board game to play on the road?
You know, we exclusively play a dice game called Farkle, which isn't technically a board, but we do play it on a table.
Tabletop.
So I think I'm going to go tabletop game, Farkle.
Farkle is sweeping the nation. Have you noticed? Is it you that's doing it?
It honestly could be.
Are you having a Farkle set open your tour?
Not yet. We're not ruling it out, but we have taught so many bands and random strangers and friends of friends at bars across the country over the course of the last 2 years. It could be us. Right. I didn't know it was sweeping the nation because we're just living in it. But if it's catching on, we're participating at the very least.
Hell yeah. Okay. What is your favorite church hymn?
Whoa. I love the melody of What Child Is This, the Christmas one, but that's because it's like an old pagan song. It's all about the melody.
We didn't even get into paganism.
Next time.
Bugs or birds?
Can't have one without the other.
Don't answer this question the same way. Flowers or trees?
Do you really have to pick? I guess it's a lightning round. Mm-hmm. Trees.
What is the best Bob Dylan song?
Girl from the North Country.
Oh, that is a good one. And you cover that. I've seen it happen.
I do. Yeah.
This is the last one. Make it count. Where is the most beautiful place in the world?
I don't know. I know lots of beautiful places, but I don't know. Yeah.
Fair answer.
Yeah.
Isn't it the upper Minnesota, the northern
Mississippi River Valley?
Yes.
That, for me, yes, that is the spot. But I'm open to other people's opinions and I'll gladly travel to see. Yeah. Always looking for beautiful places.
That was it. That's the lightning round.
Yeah.
That's the end of the interview. We both did really great.
Aww.
Round of applause.
Yeah, thank you, Cindy.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by CJ Nungesser. Alex Stanton composes our music. Basic Folk is on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. You can find all of our episodes there. You can search for us on the SiriusXM app under Basic Folk. You can find us on Folk Alley's mobile app and folkalley.com, basicfolk.com, or wherever you get podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode of Basic Folk, you should send it to a friend. Maybe your friend
who lives in the Twin Cities and is very into learning about new artists from that area, because I feel like music fans in that area are incredibly awesome and they might enjoy a super cool deep dive about Minnesota's very own Humbird. Share it with that friend. All right, thanks for listening all the way to the end. We'll talk to you next time. Bye.